All right, we're beginning here on the top of Ayin Gilmad Aleph with the Mishnah. The Mishnah begins, Eluin Shemetzilin Otan Binafshan. These are individuals who you saved them with their nefesh, with their lives. Already here, there's a controversy within the Rishonim to understand who exactly are we saving, with whose life are we saving over here. You can see in Rashi right away, Ve'elu Shemetzilin Otan Min Aveira. We are saving the perpetrator of the crime from doing the crime, binafshan, which is with their own lives. So the way Rashi is reading the Mishnah is that we're killing the perpetrator of the crime to protect him or stop him from committing that crime. It's obvious that the victim is important based on the list that we'll see in the Mishnah. But on the other hand, it seems from the language that's used here, the way that Rashi interprets it, is Elo Matzilin Otan binafshan, the person we're speaking about here is the perpetrator of the crime. And the one we're saving is saving him from doing the crime, not saving the victim themselves. So that is both something that is ambiguous in the language of the Gemara, as well as a machloket in the Rishonim. It's most visible in the Tosafot later on, Latzilo b'nafsho, where he discusses this exact issue and says that it's unclear from the Gemara which way to go. Harodeif achar chaverod arago. Person is chasing up another individual to kill them. You have a right to take the life of the rodeif to protect the individual who is going to be killed or to stop this individual from committing murder. V'achara zachar, someone is running after someone to sodomize them. V'achara na'ara me'urasa, or they're chasing after a young woman who is halakhically engaged in order to perpetrate a crime with her. All three of those, you're allowed to take the life of the perpetrator of the crime. On the other hand, about rodeif achar beima, someone's chasing an animal down to perform bestiality with it. Ve'mechalel et haShabbat, someone who is going to violate Shabbat. Ve'oved avodat kochavim, or someone's going to worship avodah zarah. Ein matzilin otan binafshan. Over there, you do not save them with their lives. So here, in the latter part of the Mishnah, there is no victim. The worst victim we have is an animal, which generally we see as servicing man and not being an independent entity. But you have no victims in the latter half of the Mishnah, which seems to indicate that a victim is important in killing the individual to stop them from perpetrating the crime. So again, that would leave in favor of saying that the victim is important, not the perpetrator of the crime or the severity of the crime. The most obvious to that is the fact that Oved Kochavim is left out. So that tells you severity of crime is not the determining factor. Because if it was the determining factor, Shabbat and Avodah Zarah, by definition, would have been at the top of the list, and you would have taken the life of the individual to stop them from doing that. The fact that that's not the case shows you it's not about the severity of the crime. And that means you have to involve the victim here, or the victim is important to the fact that we take the life of the perpetrator of the crime. And you can see that in the Bali HaTosafot. He says that the halacha lo kapid krai sura ela pigima. It's clear here, and this is what I was noting to you before, that Tosafot points out, it's clear here that the Torah is not after the isur that you're violating, but rather the damage done to the victim that's there. Pshita yesh pagam gadol b'nerag mibinara amrasa shenensa. And all of these are issues where the pagam is significant. And again, here, Naram Rasa is subject to Skila. Someone who kills is only subject to the killing by Saif, which would indicate Naram Rasa is much more severe. Nevertheless, the Bali Tosafot would say it's just logical that Pagam of Naram Rasa can't be greater than the Pagam of killing. A person who is victimized by being killed is the worst Pagam that you can have. If the Naram Rasa is Nifkima, she's still alive afterwards. It's a terrible thing, but she's still alive. On the other hand, if you kill someone, it is serious pagam. And therefore, Tosafot is focused on this concept or this issue of pagam. The question is, where do you know that from? Where do you know that the victim is important to the factor? Tosafot quotes Rashi later on, who says, the Bekuntri spiritual command, abgimat kapid megali behane v'lo ba'averot acherot. The fact that the Torah says you can take the life of the individual in these sins and not in other sins shows you or demonstrates for you that pagam is important. Otherwise, the list wouldn't make sense. And then he does bring Od Yesh Lamar, Dei Moshiela Mashma Da Bushta Kapid Kra, that the Torah says that there is no savior for this woman, this Nara Murasa, which means that the Torah is worried about her being saved. The Torah is worried about the embarrassment and the pagam that will result of this act. And so that teaches you that pagam is central to the issue. Again, once you put pagam as central issue over here, that's more about the victim than it is about the perpetrator of the crime. And so that's the balance that you're trying to strike here, or trying to figure out, which is it that is contributing to the necessity to kill this individual. And again, Rashi focuses on the perpetrator of the crime. Tosafot is very much focused on the... All right, Tanu Banan. Minayin lirodef achar chaveiro laragosh niten latzilo benafsho. How do you know that when a person is chasing another individual to kill them, that you have a right to take the life of the aggressor, the life of the one who's trying to murder over here? Tamil Omar, lo damod adam reacha. You may not stand idly by while your friend's blood is being lost. The way Rashi interprets the pasuk is, lo tamod atzmecha. Do not be still. Do not be passive, al damo, in the face of your friend's dam, his blood. Ela hatzileu. Take action. Be active. Engage. So the instruction of the pasuk of lo tamod adam reacha, tamod here means an indication of passivity. Don't be passive while your friend's blood is at risk. You must engage. You must be active. That's what that pasuk comes to teach you. We need it for this braita. How do you know that if you see your friends drowning, or wild animals attacking him, or marauders are attacking him, that you have an obligation to intercede, protect him, help him out? So that's what that pasuk's for. The pasuk's coming to teach you that you have an obligation to save your friend's life. Not in an instance where he's going to be murdered, but in an instance where his life is in danger. Whether that's because there are animals chasing after him, whether that's because he's drowning. And these aren't necessarily cases or situations where there's an outside party that's coming and causing the problem. Listim might be. But in the other cases, these are issues that arise for the individual themselves, not being perpetrated by anybody else. Yet you still have an obligation to help them out, to rescue them in those cases. It says, Enoch Anami, you're right. That's what that pasuk's for. Vela nitan atzilo benafsho minalan. So then where do we know this, that you're allowed to kill to save the other person's life? So in the case of lo tamod adam reacha, it does teach you that you have an obligation to save your friend, but it doesn't permit you to do is murder someone else, kill someone else to save your friend. What it says is you have to engage to take him out of a situation of danger. It doesn't permit you necessarily to kill another individual in order to save his life. Where do we know that from? Atya b'kal v'chomer mi nara murasa. We learn it out logically from nara murasa. Ma nara murasa shelo ba'ila lefogma. In a case of nara murasa, where the ultimate problem is that she's going to be nifgema. We'll see later in the Gemara, Rashi will note this. Nifgema is, first of all, she's going to lose her bitulim. Number two is, she's going to be ma'usa al-bala. Her husband is not going to be so excited anymore about his wife because she's been violated. So these are the pagam that we're speaking about. There's tremendous embarrassment also associated with this. There, Amra Torah, nitan latzila b'nafsho. Over there it says you can save her life b'nafsho with his nefesh, meaning with the perpetrator's life. Here, where the person's trying to kill, eliminate, snuff out a life, then certainly you should be able to rescue that person with the life of the perpetrator of the crime. So now over here, two things. One is, there's an assumption in the Gemara that you can protect the Nara Murasa in this way. The Gemara will get to that in 1 second, as to why that is the case. The second thing is, this is one of Tosafot's proofs that the Gemara is hard to read. Which is, Tosafot over here says, Mashma'ut alashon. From the language over here, Matzilin anirdap b'nafsho shel odef. We save the victim with the life of the one who's chasing the aggressor. Avaloita kein lefareish. You can't explain kein b'rodef achara behema. Can't say that about running after an animal. Ukayotseba. In those situations, there's no reason to save the nirdaf b'nafsho shel rodef. I mean, you don't save an animal by taking the life of the individual. That's an imbalance over there that doesn't make sense. You also, by Shabbat, Avodah Zarah, you're not going to take the life of the individual to save the Avodah Zarah, to save Shabbat. Those aren't human beings that need to be saved in those cases. And therefore, Tosfot comes around to what Rashi said in the Mishnah, which is, why then would you even have a Havamina? The way that we explained it, it's obvious why Shabbat, Avodah Zarah, and Behemah are precluded from taking the person's life, because you're trying to protect the victim. There are no victims in those cases. So then why does the Torah have to come to specifically preclude those issues? So therefore, it must be the way to read this is, and the way that Rashi read it on the Mishnah, and this is probably what compelled Rashi to do it in the Mishnah, is that you're allowed to save the person from committing the Avera by taking his life. That's exactly how Rashi interpreted the Mishnah. But then he says, Avakasha minara murasa. The only problem is the line we just read in the Gemara. The line that we read in the Gemara says, with regards to a nara amurasa, nitan hatzila binafsho. Hatzila means save her, binafsho with his life. That makes it read that the reason you're killing him is to save her. And so that language goes against what the Tosafot just concluded. Therefore, Tosafot here is going back and forth and saying, listen, I think what Rashi says makes sense, otherwise why would you have a Havamina and include other severe crimes like Shabbat, the Avodah Zarah, and we have a Pasuk to exclude them? But if that's the case, then how do I explain the language of the Gemara, which seems to indicate we're protecting the victim and not the aggressor? We're not stopping him from an Avera. And that's what I said to you before, that this Tosafot seems to indicate that Gemara is somewhat ambiguous about this issue. The truth is that it might be a little bit of both, and that might be the real answer here, which is the reason you could take his life is because both the Avera that he's going to commit, as well as the victim that is going to be hurt by the crime. The combination of the two together is what gives you the right or gives you the possibility of taking his life. And maybe in the end, that's what the Gemara is noting in its ambiguity, is the fact that you need both aspects in order for it to be significant enough or serious enough to take the life of an individual. It's not enough just to have a severe violation of an Avera. It's not enough just that there is a victim. You need the two together, and that's what grants you the right to take his life. Now, Tosafot says, once you do this, and you suggest that we're going to learn out of a Kal v'chomer from a Nara Merasa, and we know that you're allowed to take the life of an individual in order to protect the victim who's being killed, then why do we need Lo Tamod Al Dam Re'acha? Now we've established that you're allowed to take someone's life to protect the person. In an instance where you don't have to take a life, certainly you have to save their life. So why do you need Lo Tamod Al Dam Re'acha? So Tosafot says something very interesting. He says, Ela Nira, Zimi Hacha, Hava Amina Asei. I would have thought that it's just an assay. There's a positive commandment to engage in saving the individual. Kamash Malan, No Tamod Adam Re'acha, teaches you the over belav, that not only is there a positive commandment to engage, there's a negative commandment not to engage. So it's not only that you should be active, or we ask you to be active. If you remain passive, you're going to violate an Aveira. Because there are two things. One is just to pass up the chance of doing it an assay. That's one thing. But now, not only are you passing up an assay, your passivity causes you to violate a law in the Torah, which is more severe. So now you're caught on both sides. First of all, you must engage. And if you don't engage, you're not only going to be just passing up an assay, you're also going to be in violation of a law. And so that's why Tosfot says you need also Lo Tamod Al Dam Re'acha. Now Tosfot asks, then we already learned yesterday that from Baba Melachteret Behukah, that the Hukah tells you that any person can intervene to stop the Baba Machteret. So why isn't that the source for the fact that a person who's with Deif Achar Ve'Ro, the Har Ego, Nitan Atzilo B'Nafsho? That should be a sufficient source for it. So first of all, you see from here that Tosfot, like Rashi, seems to equate Machteret to Rodeif, and that he's willing to learn from Machteret to other situations or circumstances of Rodeif. Number two is, Yesh Lamar, the Hotam Rishut. Over there, it's granting you permission. It's simply saying that you have a right to intervene. You don't necessarily have an obligation to intervene. The pasuk over here, or what we're looking for over here, is that you are obligated to intervene. It's not only that you have permission, you won't be held accountable, but rather you have an obligation to intervene and kill the person trying to perpetrate this crime. And that's why you need an additional source or additional pasuk to tell you it's not just permissible, but obligatory. All right. So now the Gemara says, V'chei onshin min adin? Okay, that's a really nice kal v'chomer. That's a nice logical argument that if Nara Marasa, you can save by taking the life of the aggressor, so too by the case of murder. But that's a case of logical extension. And we have a principle that the Gemara and Makot will discuss, which is Ein Onshin Min HaDin. We can't penalize, we can't punish based on a Kal V'chomer. So then that would not grant you the right to take that individual's life. That would also go back to what, a little bit of what we discussed yesterday, this Chakira, as to when you're acting in this manner, are you really an extension of Beit Din? Are you acting as a proxy for the law? Or are you simply a vigilante that the Torah gives permission to act in these cases, or maybe even demands that you act in this case? The fact that the Gemara brings Onshin Min HaDin makes it sound like this is a Kal V'chomer that involves an Onesh. Onesh is a punishment that is being imposed. That sounds like an act of Beit Din. Even though over here we're asking an individual to take action to protect another party. So here you see the Gemara again connecting between Beit Din and the individual who's carrying out the justice in this situation. The Bei Rabbi Tana Hekeshu. The Bei Rabbi says that it's actually a Hekesh. And as Rashi notes over here, once you move to a Hekesh or Gzeira Shava, it's as if it's written explicitly in the Torah. It's no longer a limud of svara. It's not a limud of a kal v'chomer. Therefore, it's not subject to the restriction of Ein Onshin Min HaDin. It's found in the pasuk in Parshat Ki Tetzé with regards to a nara hamurasa who was raped. It says, "Im besadeh yemtza ha'ish et ha'nara." If the man finds this nara murasa in the field, "Ve'achzik ba ha'ish v'shachav imah," he forcefully sleeps with her. "Umeit ha'ish v'shachav imah levado." He alone will be put to death. Vila nara lota sedavar. To the woman you will do nothing. Enara chayt mavet. She doesn't have a death penalty. Ki kasher yakum ish arei utzarcho nefesh kena davar zeh. Just like a person who gets up to murder his friend, so too is this issue. Meaning, just like the victim of a murder is innocent, so too the victim of the rape over here is innocent. Ki besadeh metzah. He found her in the field. She called out, "Ve'ein Moshiala," and there was no one to save her. So the Hekesh is in the pasuk before which it says, "Ki kasher yakum ish areyu utzarcho nefesh kena davar hazeh." Nara murasa is compared to murder in that situation, and that's Hekesh, which is "Ki kasher yakum ish areyu utzarcho nefesh b'chi ma lamadnu merotzeach." What do we learn from rotzeach? Now, the truth is that that must be a rhetorical question. Because on tomorrow's daf, we're going to learn a lot from Rotzeach. We're going to learn from Rotzeach to Nara Murasa, the din of Yehareg ve'al Yavor. There are additional little things that we also learn from Rotzeach to Nara Murasa. So the Gemara, I think, is saying this in a rhetorical manner, which is, Chima lamadnu mi Rotzeach mi'ata. Harzev balu lameid. This pasuk comes to teach. Teach means Rotzeach comes to teach about Nara Murasa. That's the comparison in the pasuk. Pasuk saying Nara Murasa is just like Rotzeach. That means Rotzeach is the teaching law, and the recipient law is Nara Murasa. Benimtza lameid. But in that process, it also ends up reversing the situation, and we learn things from Nara Murasa to Rotzeach. And that's why both the Rashi and the Tosafot add in the word af over here. Not only are you lameid, but af lameid. Not solely lameid, but also lameid, which is, mekish Rotzeach la Nara Murasa. Ma Nara Murasa nitein latzila b'nafsho. Just like by the Nara Murasa, you're able to save the victim, the woman, with the life of the perpetrator. Af Rotzeach nitein latzila b'nafsho. So too the Rotzeach, you can save the victim of the murder with the life of the murderer. V'nara murasa gufa minalan. How do you know that a nara murasa, that you're permitted to take the life of the aggressor in that case? Get a tana of Bei Rabbi Shmuel. The tana of Bei Rabbi Shmuel. V'ein moshiala. That's what we read in the pasuk. She was out in the field. She cried out and there was no savior. Ha yesh moshiala. If there was a savior, b'chol davar she'chol oshia. Sounds like he should have intervened. Meaning that the reason that she wasn't saved and she's considered to be an innocent victim is because nobody could come and save her. But that implies that if there was somebody to save her, they should have intervened, should have interceded, and saved her life in any way that they can. The Minchat Chinuch actually raises an issue as to whether the issue of Rodef applies to an individual themselves. If a party tells another person to kill them, is that other party considered to be a Rodef? The example he brings is when Shaul tells his weapons bearer to kill him, does the weapons bearer then become a rodef? Are you only a rodef when you don't have permission of the victim? Or when you have permission of the victim, you are still considered to be a rodef. He wants to lean towards saying that the person is not a rodef because of the language used in the Mishnah, which is a rodef, achar chavero, which seems to imply that it's the redifa, it's the chasing bal korcho of the victim that makes it that there is a din of rodef here, implying that if it was consensual, meaning that the individual agrees to being killed, there would not be a din of rodef over here. Although he then suggests that maybe over here, the din of rodef has to do with the protection of the victim or protection of the life lost over here. And if that's the case, it should be irrespective of whether it's done bal korcho or it's done with his consent. It should still be restricted and the person should be classified as a rodef. So this goes back to the question as to whether we're trying to prevent someone from doing something wrong or we're trying to save the victim in these situations. And since a person's life is not in their own hands, they don't have a right to forfeit their life, and they're acquiescing to their being killed is not a carte blanche to the killer, and therefore you'd be deemed as a rodef. And the Minchat Chino leaves that as a tzarech iyun. Alright, so the Gufa, now the Gemara goes back to deal with minayin roet chavero shu tovea benar, o chaya gororto, o listim bayim alav, shu chaya latzilo. So this goes back to the question about saving someone's life. How do we know that when the person's in danger that you have to actively get involved and save their life? Tamalomar lo tamod o dam reyacha. Da'am e'acha nafka? Is that where we learn it from? Me'otam nafka. We learn it out from the din of Aveda. Avedat gufo minayin. How do you know that not only do you have to return an object to an individual when their object has been lost, what happens if they're going to lose their life? Do you have the obligation to return their life to them? So just like you have to return their monetary possessions to them, you also have to return their life to them. How do we know that? Tamar lomar veshevoto lo. Now, the pasuk speaking about you return the object, meaning the lost item, to the individual. But the way that it is phrased, it says veshevoto lo, as if it is saying you return him to himself. How do you return him to himself? Obviously by giving him his life, saving his life. So from there, the Gemara learns that you have an obligation to save the individual's life. So now we have two psukim that are telling you the same information. When a person's in danger, you have an obligation to intercede. Lo tamod odam re'acha, and also ve'ashevo tolo. Why do I need two psukim to teach me the same din? Imi otam, had I learned it from there, havamina hane mile benafshe. Your obligation is intercede physically to use whatever efforts you can to save the individual. Aval mitrach umigar agure emalo. If you have to undertake hiring people, spending money, or tremendous effort to save the individual, maybe there you have no obligation to do it. Kamash malon, that you have the other pasuk which says, lo tamod odam re'acha, that you have the obligation even if it costs you money, and you have an obligation even if it involves tircha, a great undertaking to save the individual's life. You don't just have an obligation when you're standing there to jump in and intercede because you can do whatever it is with your own hands and save him. You have an obligation to pay other people to try to save him. And you also have an obligation to engage in tircha and undertake whatever is needed in order to save this individual's life. And the truth is, now that you have the conclusion from Lo Mutamo Lo Dam Reyacha that implies even a monetary obligation, even a tircha, then why do you need vashevel tolo? You could argue that you would have not gotten to that. You would have thought no tamo damayach also only means nefesh, and you need both psukim to get you there. Or you could suggest that had you just had lo tamo damayach, it would seem to indicate that the obligation to help him out is only in cases of sakana. In cases that are not sakana or other matzavim, how do you know vashevel tolo, that you have to help him out to save his guf, to save his life? That comes from Eshevot Olo, teaches you that in any circumstance, not just in Sakanat Nefashot, you have an obligation to help the individual to preserve his life. Okay, so that brings up the issue as to how far this goes, or how big is the obligation on you to save your friend's life. Generally, we have a principle that Chayecha Kodmin, that your life takes precedence over your friend's life. Whenever there's a choice there, we're not going to obligate you to die so that the other individual can live, because Chayecha Kodmin. So that's the same question you have to ask now with regards to how far or how far reaching is this requirement that you go out of your way to help your friend, both physically, monetarily, and undertaking. Where does that end? So most mifashim indicate that there is no necessity to endanger your life in order to do that. You don't have to put yourself in danger in order to save their life. Question of how much that means. Does that mean it's sakanat nefashot? Or does it mean safek sakanat nefashot? What happens if there's a safek with regards to it? There are some tshuvot. There, some of them are heart-wrenching, to be honest with you. But there are tshuvot, first of all, about if an individual has the obligation to give up a limb in order to save his friend. For instance, the Shuta Radbaz discusses a case where the government basically said, if we cut off your arm, we'll spare the life of your friend. If we don't cut off your arm, then your friend is going to be killed by the government, executed by the government. Do you have an obligation to give up your arm to save the other individual? There, you're not necessarily in danger. I mean, it could be a safek sakanat nefashot if there's an infection or something. But in general, it's just a matter of giving up an eifer for the benefit of another party. Are you obligated? So there in the tshuva, he discusses the fact that you don't have an obligation to give up an eifer. There is no demand that your body be maimed in order to help other people, even though it might be a midat chasidut to do that, because obviously the trade-off between a limb and a life, life should obviously take precedence, but a person's not under an obligation to do that, to maim themselves, or endanger themselves in order to save the life of another individual. That leads the Tzitz Eliezer in a very interesting tshuva. He writes the tshuva in a period of time where I think that there's enough medical evidence that it's really not dangerous, but he suggests over there that one may not be obligated to donate blood to save another individual. Donating blood involves, he indicates, is a pain, because you have to have a needle inserted into the individual. Discomfort. And there he speaks about sakanat nefashot. He speaks about the fact that you might be endangering your life. I think today it's very clear from the literature that the donation of blood and the amounts that they take out do not endanger the individual's life and not dangerous in any way, which would seem to then obligate you to give dam because of the requirement of lo tamod o dam reyacha when you can save another party, that you shouldn't do it. Although there are other poskim that make it clear that if an individual who gives blood is left in either terrible pain or dysfunctional for another day or two afterwards because they're so weak that they clearly don't have an obligation to give that blood, because you don't have an obligation to put yourself in tsar, to put yourself in difficulty in order to save the other individual's life. But there are situations or circumstances where if you don't give the blood, it's going to precipitate even worse things. Maybe that there's going to be a plague or nobody's going to treat this individual over there. One should seriously consider whether it's not worth taking a little pain or discomfort to help the other individual. But most of the poskim see that as being a midat chasidut, but not an obligation to put yourself in that danger. But there are poskim who think that you do have to at least put yourself in safek sakanat nefashot in order to save the life of the individual. Obviously not into sakanat nefashot, but safek. And you have to balance carefully. Many times when someone's drowning, the person who goes out to save the individual, unfortunately, drowns trying to save the individual. So you have to be very careful about that and discerning, because there's no obligation, again, to give up your life. You have to assess the situation as to whether you're going out there is going to be significantly beneficial and low risk to you, or the risk just as high to the individual who goes out there to save as the individual is already in danger. In that case, you will not have an obligation to engage because it's too dangerous for you to engage in such a situation. So the question of army and soldiers who definitely put their lives on the line, there it might be obligatory. And that is based on what the Chinuch says with regards to war. War, by definition, involves sakanat nefashot. Anyone who puts on a uniform as going to be a soldier, by definition, war is sakanat nefashot. You can't say, oh, I'm not putting my life in danger. War, by definition, demands that you put your life in danger. If the Torah requires one to engage in a milchemet mitzvah or in a battle, by definition, it's waiving the consideration of sakanat nefashot, because that's embedded in the mitzvah, or embedded in the understanding of being a chayav. So that means a soldier will be obligated, despite the safek sakanat nefashot, to engage. That means in situations where there's danger and there's a terrorist involved, that they have to go out there and they have to engage with the terrorists, despite the fact that it might be dangerous to their lives. The question will come up with civilians. Do civilians have the obligation in that case to engage? They're not in uniform. They're not under that obligation that says you must enter into sakanat nefashot. So then a civilian, do they have an obligation to intervene in terrorist cases? Do we classify that as being a situation where there's an obligation to engage because of the fact that there's so much danger, and maybe even it's a milchemet mitzvah in that situation, and that means that you even take chatan michedro, you take everybody goes out to battle, and then we all become the army. The army is not just the army anymore, the army is all civilians because of the nature of the attacks and the terrorist attacks. If that's the case, then even a civilian would be obligated. On the other hand, if you don't feel that that's so far-reaching, then soldiers would definitely be obligated. Civilians would only be optional to engage. They wouldn't be a violation of lo tamoto dam reyecha if it's sakanat nefashot. So therefore, you would have to adjust, or you'd have to assess every situation as to how much sakana is involved in you engaging or you trying to stop a terrorist, and whether you have to engage or whether maybe it's smarter not to engage in those situations. Again, then you'd have to assess each one separately. But that has to do with how you assess the threat of terror in general as to what type of battle that is and who is considered to be the army that is battling that terrorism. Right. A kidney donation to me is clearly in the optional category. There are complications that can happen. They are very low. The sakana is very low. But there are chances. And a person is not obligated to undergo any pain or discomfort to save the other individual. So in that case, it would not be obligatory. It would definitely be a midat chasidut. Again, it might be a really good thing. It might be that there's very low danger. The age of the individual, the effects that it could have on their family, all those situations have to be assessed in that consideration. But I think there it would be more along the lines of midat chasidut rather than an obligation with regards to organ donations. I mean, obviously when the person's alive, they're dying, that has to do with a separate question, which is what is considered to be the moment of death and whether you can donate organs or not is a separate halakhic issue. Just as a separate issue, I do think that the obligation to save someone else's life, that also applies to oneself. That the same way that you have an obligation to save another person's life, you also have an obligation to save your own life. And that means that you have to take precautions or measures to save your own life. Whether that means wearing a seatbelt, or that means wearing a helmet when you are biking. All those types of precautions, to me, come under the same restriction, which is they are an obvious outcome. Also, things like smoking, in those types of situations, they may also involve this violation of these restrictions, which is that obligation to save someone else also devolves upon you to save yourself and protect your own life. And there are other requirements in the Torah to protect yourself and to treat yourself properly, but I think that not only do those apply over here, which is that you have an obligation, and this is an additional obligation, which is you have to protect other people's lives, and that includes your own life when you have to protect. So now here you have a braita that expands on the Mishnah to include other victims that would be subject to the same rule. The three of our Mishnah are mentioned here in the braita, which is murder, nara murasa, and sodomization. And now the braita adds on any erva subject to a death penalty, whether that's a death penalty at the hands of Beit Din or a death penalty by Karet, they are subsumed under this requirement to save the individual with the life of the perpetrator. So here are additional victims who qualify enough that we're going to take the life of the perpetrator. Almanah Kohen Gadol, on the other hand, if you have an almanah who's being chased by a Kohen Gadol who's going to rape her, Grusha v'chalutza l'Kohen Ejot, Kohen Ejot is chasing Grusha v'chalutza, these are all restricted, but they're only restricted by a lav, not restricted by karet or chiyuv meitid beitin. Ein matzilin otan b'nafsho. We do not save them by taking the life of the aggressor, even though over here there is pegam that is caused. Over here, the woman afterwards will be deemed a chalala. She will be psula for kuhuna after this point because she'll be violated by an iser kuhuna. Nevertheless, that's not strong enough. That's not enough of an issue for us to take the life of the perpetrator. Nevda ba'avera, once the crime or the avera has already been committed, then you don't kill the individual. So this focuses very much on the perpetrator of the crime, which is once the avera has already been committed, there's no reason to kill them because you're not going to save them from the avera. The truth is that you're also not possibly going to save the victim anymore because the victim's already been nifkam. And so there you're killing them, you're not doing anything. Yesh la moshia, ein matzino ta b'nafsho. So this goes to your question. If there is salvation, then you can't take their life. If there's some way or someone that can stop the aggressor over here without taking their life, you don't have a right to take the life of the individual. You can't use fatal force when there are alternatives. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Afa Omeret, Hanichu Lo, Shelo Yargena. If she speaks up and says, don't come, don't save me, because she's afraid he's going to kill her. She's in a position where he's going to rape her. He hasn't reached her yet, he hasn't succeeded. But she tells the saviors to back off because she's afraid if they do get closer, if they do come close to saving her, that he's just going to kill her. So she's afraid for her own life. When she says that, we listen to her, even though she might be saying it because she's just fearful or she's just afraid, and therefore she's saying it. Nevertheless, we respect her wishes in that case, and we don't continue to pursue the aggressor, take out the aggressor, because the victim has said that they don't want that. Menani Mile. How do we know this is the case? Amar Kra, the Pasuk says, Umanara lotase davar. So now, this is true of all the Tzufim that are brought in that Parshia in Pesha Kedetze, which is, the word Nara always is spelled as Na'ar. It's not spelled Nara, the hay is missing from all of those words. It's obvious from the context that the word is Nara, so we pronounce it Nara, even though it's spelled as Na'ar. So that's going to be one of the Drashot. And then the remainder is the excessive language that's used over here, which is Ulanara lo tase davar. Then it says in la nara chet mavet. Don't do anything to the nara. So then it's obvious in la nara chet mavet. The in la nara chet mavet always becomes extraneous when you already told me don't do anything to the nara. So those extraneous words are what the pasuk is darshening now, which is Ulanara lo tase davar in la nara chet mavet. Naar ze zachur. That teaches you when there's possibility of forced sodomization, that you are allowed to save the life. Na'ara, zo na'ara hamurasa. That teaches you that a na'ara hamurasa you protect with the life of the aggressor. Chet, elu chayevei kretot. That teaches you that any victim by which the crime that's perpetrated would be subject to a karet, you also then save them by killing the aggressor. Mavet, elu chayevei mitot beitin. That's for things that the courts would enforce and execute for. Kohani lamali, why do I need all of these? Meaning that if you told me one, wouldn't I be able to extrapolate the others? Why do I need each one of them? Tsriche, we need each one of them. Itak adav rachman and na'ar, if the Torah just wrote na'ar mishum dalav or chay, because the sodomization is not a normal act. It's an act that is abnormal, and that abnormality is more embarrassing and more of a pagam. So that reason itself, if you had just told me about Mishkav Zachor, I would have thought that's the reason you kill the perpetrator of the crime. But in a case where it's Nara Murasa, where Bia is the normal way to have Bia, and it's normal for a man and a woman to engage, even though obviously in this case it's problematic, that's less of a pagam. Aval Nara Dorcha, Imalo, maybe there we wouldn't save the woman by taking the life of the aggressor. Vikatav Rachmana Nara, Mishom de kapogimla, because over there he is in a sense ruining her, as Rashi says over here. De pogimla bibitulim, she's going to lose her virginity here. Umiganel bala, and in addition to that, he's going to make her maus. There are words her husband here, and we're going to see this in a second. That has significant meaning in the context of nara murasa. Aval nara de lo kapogimla, over there he doesn't leave quote unquote physical damage or permanent damage on the individual. It's psychological, it's embarrassment. Maybe over there you can't take the life of the individual. Aim alone. So there maybe you can't take the life of the individual. If you wrote both of these, Mishum Dehailav Orchehu, Vahakapagimla. Because in one instance, it's not the normal way, the sodomization. The other instance, you have Pagam. Avashara Rayot, De Orchayu, Velo Nafish Pigmayu. That it is the normal way of Biyaz, a man and a woman. And number two is, the pagam is not as severe. Why is that? So here Rashi explains. Below nafish pigmayu ke arusa, shechaviva v'yalet chayin al arus. There's a unique relationship between a couple that is engaged, and that the husband who is anxiously awaiting the marriage to his wife, v'achshav mitgane alav. And now, this makes her ma'us, disgusting, or in some way violated and spoiled for the arus. So there's a unique relationship between an arus and an arusa which has implications for halacha here as well as in other places. Over here has implications because the begam is a higher level of begam. Not only are you losing bitulim, you're also losing that unique connection between the arus and the arusa, and their relationship now is being in some senses tested or strained because of this situation. A woman who is single and is raped, there's begam there because of the loss of the bitulim, but on the other hand, she doesn't have a relationship with anybody yet, and then someone who will come to marry her later on will accept it or know that that's the fact before they start out. It wasn't that they took a bitulah and then that was changed or that situation was changed after they engaged. They're going to engage with a woman who's not a bitulah to start with. So the begam is less than. A married woman is already not a bitulah. She's already a bi'ulah. So yes, there's begam for the husband. There is a violation of the woman. All the problems are associated with that, but it doesn't have the bitulim aspect. The arusai uniquely has both of those aspects together. It has the problem of the bitulim and the problem of the begam all in one, and that's why it's more severe. That also has implications with regards to war, which is which individuals are allowed to return from war. One of the individuals that's permitted to come back is a person who is halakhically engaged, but has yet to take his wife, has yet to marry her. That unique relationship of an arus and arusa allows him to return to the battle in order to marry his wife and to consummate the marriage. Because the aglan nefesh of not being able to do that is so great that the Torah sees that as being a priority to bring them back from the war in order to allow the marriage to take place. So you see again that unique relationship of an arus and arusa that allows them to come back from the battle. So that's why you would have thought that the other arayot are not included. So in those cases, we would think that the other arayot don't have it. So that's why the Torah writes chayt to tell you, chayve kreto. Had written chayt, I would think not only chayve kreto, but even chayve lavin. So that teaches you death. It has to be something that's subject to a death penalty, whether that's at the hands of Beit or in the hands of God. Had just written that, avamina chayve meto beitin. In, then only things that have severity of things that can be executed by Beit Din, those you have a right to kill the individual. Chayve kretot, lo. Chayve kretot, which are a lower level, maybe not. Katar brachmana, chayt. And that's why the Torah wrote chayt to teach you even chayve kretot. Velitoch brachmana chayt and mavet, velo bayi nar v'nara. So just write chayt and mavet, and everything here would be subsumed. Because once you know that chayve mitot Beit Din, as well as chayve kretot, are subject to this rule that you take the life of the aggressor to protect them, then certainly a sodomization or a nar marasa, which are subject to the penalty of skila, certainly they'd be included, especially since they have the additional factors of lav keorchayu and pegam. Then you wouldn't need them. Why do you have to write all of these items? So Gemara says, ain't ochanami. The Gemara says, you're right. That's all you need. Ela nar v'nara. So then why do you need nar v'nara? Because now chayt and mavet teach you everything. What do you need nar v'nara for? Chad mutei obeid avodat kochavim, chad mutei behema v'shabbat. One of them comes to exclude the case of avodah zarah, and one of them comes to exclude the case of behema and shabbat. Rashi over here says you don't need chilul shabbat to be excluded, because chilul shabbat, we'll see in 1 second, is only a kal v'chomer from avodah zarah. So if you were allowed to kill for avodah zarah, then you would possibly think you would have to kill for Shabbat. But without that connection, you wouldn't. So once you've eliminated avodah zarah, you don't need Shabbat to be excluded. And therefore Rashi says it's just brought down a gav gerora, and that it's really excluding avodat kochavim and excluding behema. Those are the two items, and that's the question you asked before. How does the Mishnah get its list? Nara and Nara teach you only those individuals, not avodat kochavim, not behema. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, damar oveid avodat kochavim nitan natzilo benafsho. Lamali. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai argues on our Mishnah, on the Tan of our Mishnah, and says that avodah zarah is included in those crimes or those aveirot where you have the right to take the life of the individual in order to prevent them from committing the crime. So then what does he need nar v'nara to do? Chadimute be'ema. One comes to exclude be'ema. Chadimute shabbat. One comes to exclude chilul shabbat. Sakadat chamina. Teite Shabbat mechilul chilul meavodat kochavim. You have a gzeirah shavah of chilul, just like by Shabbat, you're not allowed to be michalel the Shabbat, and so too by avodah zarah, which is a chilul. So that gzeirah shavah would have taught you that, just like by avodah zarah, you're allowed to take the individual's life. So to over here, by Shabbat, you'd be able to take the person's life to prevent them from violating Shabbat. That's what Nair and Nara come to exclude. One comes to exclude Shabbat, and one comes to exclude Behema. Hold on, Rabbi Lazar or Rabbi Shimon? Rabbi Shimon by Yochai's son, Adamar Mechalel to Shabbat, Nitan Atzilo B'Nafsho. So he thinks even for Shabbat, you're allowed to take the life, prevent them from being Mechalel Shabbat. Rabbi Shimon by Yochai adds in Avodah Zarah. His son adds in, on top of that, Shabbat. Then Atzi Shabbat, Mechilol Me'abudat Kochabim. We have the Gzeir Shavah of Chilol from Avodah Zarah that teaches you by Shabbat also. Ma'ika LeMeimar, what are you going to do with Nar V'Nara? Chad miut limute beima. One of them you'll say to exclude beima. Ve'idach, aydi dichtav rachmana na'ar, katav nami na'ara. It's just the way that the Torah writes it over here. It writes na'ar, na'ara, because that's the way it's written in the whole parsha. It's not going to teach you anything in additional. There's one limud that you had up over here, not two limudim that come out of this. So over here you have a different view from Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and from Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon, which clearly focus on the severity of the crime, not necessarily on the victim. They add in these additional items because they clearly believe that Avodah Zarah and Shabbat are the types of Aveirot that are so severe that we're going to protect the violation of those by taking the life of the perpetrator. So from here, it also becomes clear that the focus is on the violator, the one who's doing the Aveirah. Happens to be that the Tanakhama of our Mishnahs has miutim that exclude it. But without those miutim, it would seem to focus on the perpetrator of the crime, the aggressor. And that's why Rashi on the Mishnah and Tosafot both seem to indicate that that's what's driving the driving force here. Even though in the end, it does become important, the victims, because that's the determination as to where we see severity and victim coinciding to tell you that you have to take the life of the individual. The Tosafot over here asks the question, he says, Ve'echi chalel Shabbat, letzil ha'vero michilul Shabbat. The question you have here is, if it's Shabbat, and he's about to violate Shabbat, so what do? You go and you take his life, you kill him. Killing an individual on Shabbat is the violation of Shabbat. So how could that be logical, that your violation of Shabbat, to stop someone else from violating the Shabbat, what have you gained in the end? If the whole point is to stop chilul Shabbat, you haven't done that. You're being Mechalel Shabbat in order to stop Chilul Shabbat. On a net basis, you still have Chilul Shabbat over here. So why should that be permitted? So those that want to suggest that it's a Melacha Sheina Tzricha the Gufa, therefore you are a Patur. But then Tosafot says, Dein Zeh Mekalkel B'Chabura, Dikei Tekune Gavra, Kevin D'Mechayiv Mita. And you can't make a claim that this is Mekalkel, that this is not a constructive force, but a destructive force. And since it's a destructive force on Shabbat, Mekalkel Bechabura is considered to be Potura of Alasur, means it's only Asur Midrabanan, not Asur Midoraita. So over here, when one kills the individual, they are only doing Mekalkel Bechabura, and therefore you should not be in violation of Shabbat. He says that's not true. Over here you have what's called Tikkuni Gavra. You are doing what needs to be done to this individual. You're doing something constructive by taking their life, because you're saving them from perpetrating the crime. You are taking their life based on the obligation that they're chayav mita. So that's actually a constructive act, not a destructive act. Even though chabura and killing in and itself is a destructive act, it's towards a constructive purpose. And therefore Tosafot says you should be in violation of Shabbat. V'yesh lamar, kimikom makom, sakadatcha gzeret hakatuv, k'Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Shimon. That the point is that it's gzeret hakatuv. You learn that as gzer shava of chilul. And that Gzeir Shabbat teaches you that the Torah says you take the life, even though there will be Chilul Shabbat over here. We see the issue being so important and such a breach of the standards of the Torah that we think that the violation of Shabbat, to stop the violation of Shabbat, is worthwhile in these two cases, both as a deterrence to others, as well as to stop the individual from engaging in Chilul Shabbat. Whereby the person who's killing is not considered to be Mechalel Shabbat, because the Torah permits it, and it's a Gzeirat HaKatuv, that you're allowed to do it, despite the Chilul Shabbat that is involved. I mean that you're given permission by the Torah to do it, so it's no longer Chilul Shabbat. Other Rishonim take different approaches over here. There are those that suggest that that Kapara, or that Tikkun Gavra, is only accomplished when Beitin executes the individual, not when it's taken into the hands of individuals to put him to death. Again, that goes back to the chapira we spoke before. Is the individual putting him to death a proxy for Beit Din, an extension of the judicial arm? In that case, maybe it has the same din in terms of kapara. On the other hand, if it's just vigilantism that the Torah condones or asks for or obligates in this case, then maybe over there you could say that it isn't constructive in nature. It is a mekalkel, and therefore it won't be a violation of Shabbat. The other interesting thing to note over here is that Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon has a gzer shavam chilul chilul. And as Tosafot points out, that by both by Shabbat and Avodah Zarah, the word chilul appears by the punishment or the death penalty. And that's why you would connect between those items. On the other hand, it's strange that Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon has a gzer shavah that his own father, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, did not have. The way that the Gemara is reading it now, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai doesn't have this gzer shavah, and he thinks Shabbat is precluded. Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon, on the other hand, does have the gzer shavah. But you need a mesorah for a gzer shavah. We do know that Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon learned by Rabbi, so it could be that he got it from Rabbi and not from Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, his father. But it's still interesting that the son has a gzer shavah that the father doesn't have, even though they're going down a similar path, which is Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says that without kuchavim is included, and Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon's statement is just an extrapolation on that, which is that Shabbat is included because Avodah Zarah is included, and nevertheless, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai thought that was not the case, and his son Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon does think it's a case, just an interesting nuance in the sugya. Right now, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Afa Omeret Inicholo Shlo Yargena, B'mai Kamitz Ligei. The Tana Kama does not have this requirement, whereas Rabbi Yehuda says you do have a requirement to desist when she requests that. Amarava b'makpedet al pigma u'minichato shelo yargena. So the machloket here is where she's clearly worried about her pigam. She obviously does not want this act to go through, but u'minichato shelo yargena. But she's requesting that they don't intervene so that the person doesn't kill her. Rabbanan sabri al pigma kapid rachmana. The Rabbanan, the Tana Kama, believe that the Torah is focused on pigam. Very makpedet al pigma. And she's clearly worried about that pigam. She clearly doesn't want to be subject to the rape of this individual. The only reason she's telling him to desist is because she's afraid for her life. And since she's afraid for her life, then she tells him to desist. But that's not what the Torah is focused on. The Torah is focused on pigam. And she's clearly worried about that pigam. If she's worried about the pigam and the Torah is makpid on pigam, then we allow you to intervene despite her protests. The reason the Torah allows you to intervene by the case of Nara Marasa is because we are afraid that this woman is going to give up her life rather than be violated. But it's clear here that she's not going to give up her life, or she doesn't want to lose her life. This goes to a Gemara that's found in the beginning of Ketubot with regards to the mistaken impression that women had. Over there, the Gemara speaks about a takana that was put in place because of a problem that existed that when women got married, they'd have to be bala hegmon tchila, that the authority in that area would sleep with the woman before she got married. There, the Gemara says that we have a problem mishum snuot and mishum prutzot. We have a problem over there. There are going to be these prutzot who are going to be fine with this, and they're going to willingly consent to that. And then there'll be a surim al-ba'alat. They'll be in violation of an extramarital affair. The other problem is we have the tsnuot. The tsnuot are the ones who will refuse to be nival dem hegmon, and they will give up their lives, even though they're not obligated to, or even though they don't have a right to. That we'll see in tomorrow's Gemara with regards to yehareg v'al yavor, whether a woman has to give up her life, or karka olam hi, that she's a passive entity over here and may not have an obligation to give up her life. So over here, mistakenly, the tsnuot will give up their lives in order not to be engaged in this activity. Similarly, Rabbi Yehuda is describing the same thing over here. The reason the Torah says intervene and protect the woman is because the woman might think she has to give up her life or might want to give up her life because she finds this to be too great a violation or something that's so severe that she'd rather lose her life than be involved in this act. So the Torah says intervene and protect her life, so that she doesn't give up her life mistakenly. But then Rabbi Yehuda says, in the case where she tells you to desist because she doesn't want to be killed, it's clear there that she's not going to give up her life. So once she declares she's not going to give up her life, we don't any longer have that obligation to intervene and take the life of the perpetrator. So that's the Ikar Machlok between them, which is, why are you allowed to intervene by the Nara Murasa? Chamim say it's all about the Begam, and the Begam problem still exists. Yehuda says it's to protect her from giving up her life. And over here, she's already declared she's not going to give up her life. So this is your question. How come if pgam is the issue, then why isn't any issue of biyah or illicit biyah problem? So then why does almanav kohen gadol not considered to be a problem? Amalei, a pigma rabba copied rachmana, a pigma zuta lo copied rachmana. The Torah is focused on large pgam or severe pgam. It's not focused on smaller pgam that gets involved. And here Rashi explains the difference. A pigma rabba could go on arayot to kretot. Shein chamurot. V'havya cherpata miruba. Over there, the embarrassment is much greater. Shavlad mamzer. If there's a child born from that, the child will be considered to be a mamzer. Nasid zona bebilato. And her status changes to that of a zona after that biyah. But by kohen gadol v'mena, inasid zona ela chalala. It's a much more limited problem of chalala. She may not marry a kohen or kohen gadol after this point in time. But that doesn't preclude her from marrying anyone else in Israel. It's also just a small problem that's there. And so the embarrassment, first of all, is less, as well as the fact that the pagam is less. And obviously the pagam is not just the physical damage that's done here, it's the psychological damage, the embarrassment. And for that reason, you can differentiate in gradations of pagam. Because it's not just about a physical pagam. The other factors that make it that the pagam can be more or less because of the embarrassment and psychological impact. So for that reason, we don't consider that to be a severe enough crime or a victim that is going to be affected as greatly to take the life of the individual. Remember, when you're killing someone, that's a very severe step that you're taking. We only take life where we think that there is a offsetting factor which is so great that it's worth taking the life of the individual. Over here, by chlala, that's not enough. By cases of busha, cherpa, mamzerut, those types of things, there the perpetrator, if he goes through with the crime, that really affects the victim greatly, and therefore you have a right to take the life of the aggressor to stop him from leaving the victim in that situation. Chet elu chayve kretot. Viramini. Ve'elu narot sheish lehem knas. These are young ladies who are entitled to get a knas if they were raped. A baal choto. Someone who rapes their sister. If they rape their sister, then obviously they have a problem, which is they're going to be chayav kretot for raping their sister, but they still have to pay her the money of the knas which comes along with the rape, the 50 shekel kesef. So even though over here you can't carry out the normal requirements of rape, which is lo tiyad isha, that this woman has to remain his wife for the rest of his life, again, if the woman doesn't want to, then she doesn't have to. But the point being that in their society where a woman post-rape would be have a hard time getting married, then this would be a way to, in a sense, save the woman and have her the ability to be married. But also, it's really trying to be a deterrent or preventive measure to tell the individual, don't think that this is a one-time thing. Don't think this is just a momentary item. You engage and rape this woman, you're going to have her for the rest of your life. The ramifications of what you are going to do are going to be with you for the rest of your life. So don't think you're just going to do this, walk away from it. That's what it means for Lotia Leisha. So even though by a brother and sister, Lotia Leisha is obviously not applicable, nevertheless, that payment of the knas is still viable and is included from a riboy in the Gemara and Ketubot. Now, even though as we saw before with the case of Machteret, when an individual is subject to a death penalty, meaning that other people are allowed to defend themselves by taking the life of the individual, over there we said a Baba Machteret is patur from the Gneva, or the Tashlumim, of breaking the item, because it's Kimlei the Rabba Mine. Why don't you say the same thing over here? This individual who is engaged in raping his sister is one of the Chayve Kretot. Now, Chayve Kretot may not be enough to free you of monetary obligations, but well, at that moment, when he's going to commit the crime, you have a right to take his life to stop him from committing the crime. So if that's the case, he is now subject to a death warrant or a death penalty, and it should be kimle derabba mine, which is that death penalty should cause that he should not have to pay the fine or he should not have to pay the knas associated. It's interesting in general because generally we say kimle derabba mine has application by monetary obligations. By knas, you can always argue that a knas or a fine is not a monetary obligation. It's a demand that the Torah places on you. It does generate a monetary obligation, but it's not money, it's knas. And that may be enough of an exception to the rule to tell you that you don't apply kimle derabba mine. The fact that the Gemara doesn't say that here seems to indicate that there is kimle derabba mine, even by knas. Although Gemara's in other places might indicate otherwise. Here, the Gemara is saying, if there is Kimelei Rabbi Minei, why does he have to pay the Knas? Amru Rabbanan Kamei the Rav Chisda, they presented this issue to Rav Chisda. Mishat Hara'a de Pigma Iftar La Miktala Mamono Lo Mishalim Ad Gemar Biya. The thresholds by which the issues take place are different. The only time Kimelei the Rabbi Minei applies, as we saw in yesterday's daf, is when the violations are simultaneous. Over here, that's not the case. When the person begins the bi'ah, the pagam has already taken place. That's what creates the pagam. The obligation to pay the fine comes from removal of the betulim, the ruining of the betulim of the woman, which happens later on. That means that the pagam happens, and at that point, the person stops being subject to a death warrant. As we saw before in the Braita, once the crime is committed, then they don't take the life of the individual. Over here, the person's already caused the pagam, has already done the act that we were trying to stop, so you no longer have a right to kill them. Then, when they continue in the act, and they remove the betulim of the woman, that obligates them in the knas. So the monetary obligation takes place subsequent to the death warrant that is on him. And for that reason, it's not subject to kimlei derabba minei. Gemara says, Hanicha lamanda amar ha'ara zunishika. So this gets to a fundamental issue that's discussed in the Gemara in Yevamot as to what is considered to be bi'ah when it comes to arayot or illicit relations. So the Torah uses the term he'ara. So he'ara means not a complete bi'ah, but a partial bi'ah. How partial it is discussed in the Gemara in Yevamot. It's a machloket. One opinion is that he'ara is simply the touching of the male member to the female genitals. That is called nishika. That's enough to be classified as a violation. On the other hand, there is a other opinion, which is that you require haknasat atara. The tip of the male member must enter the woman in order for that to be considered bi'ah. So those are the two opinions over there. Nobody thinks you need a full bi'ah. The only time that you have that is by the case of shifcha charufa, where the Torah specifically states that he slept with her shikvat zera, that he had a full bi'ah with her. In that case, you would require a complete bi'ah and finishing totally, as Rashi calls it, a bi'ah miruk. But that's not the requirement in terms of violation of arayot. So Gemara says, Anicha l'manda amar ha'ara zu nishika. The one who says that you violate the arayot already by nishika, then it makes sense, because then you're in violation as soon as the male member touches the woman. Then the betulim are only removed afterwards when he penetrates further. So given that, the begam and the death warrant stop right away, or are done right away, and then the betulim are taken out afterwards, which means the knas is after the chiyuv mita. According to the one who says that hara is defined by the penetration of the tip of the male member, then ma'ika the meimar, at the same point that the violation of the arayot of the begam happens, you're already causing the betulim to be removed, and then it's simultaneous, and it should be kimlei derabba minei. You could have killed him, so he shouldn't be chayav for paying for the betulim. Ma'ika the meimar. Tosafot over here notes that Rashi's assumption that you only pay the knas once the betulim are removed is not necessarily true, because the knas is paid irrespective of hasharat ha-betulim. Therefore, Tosafot says over here, Elahacha, hainu taima delo mishalem atchilat bi'ah mishum dekamlei berabba minei. The reason over here he doesn't pay for the violation of the woman, even without the removal of the betulim, is because at that moment there is kimlei derabba minei. Therefore he only pays by gemar bi'ah, because over there he's still removing the betulim. So even though normally you would be in violation and obligated to pay, even at the beginning of the bi'ah, even without the removal of the betulim, over here where you are exempt at that time because of kimlei derabba minei, the continued act of bi'ah still obligates you then when you remove the betulim. And that's why you're chayav. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that this din, that ha'ara, applies to arayot, may only apply in terms of violation of arayot. And that's where ha'ara is considered to be like bi'ah. On the other hand, with a case of rape, you don't have that limud of ha'ara, and therefore over there you would need bi'ah and not just he'ara to be chayav for the knas of betulim. Those are the two ways that Tosafot deals with it. Although he does bring from the Yushalmi, which seems to indicate otherwise, that he'ara does obligate one in knas. Now the Achiezer does point out from this sugya as well as Rashi over here, that the fact that the person is still chayav mita at the moment of Pagam shows you that the obligation to take his life or the ability to take the life of the individual perpetrating the crime is even when it's inevitable that the crime will happen. It's only once the crime has been committed that you get the ptur. That means that even though the person has yet to kill, but it's inevitable they're going to kill because they've already caught up with the other individual, nevertheless, it seems that you're still chayav mita here because of the kimlei derabba minei that is protecting him from having to pay the knas, according to this Gemara, the Fi Rashi. And therefore, you would still have the ability or the right, the obligation to kill this individual until they've actually killed or until they've actually raped. That obligation stays in force. That's a diuk that the Achiezer has out of Rashi. Because Rashi says, the Bishat Ara Matzilin Ota B'Nafsho Shel Rodef. The time of Ara, which is already the beginning of the Begam, inevitable that the Begam will happen, you still have a right to take the life of the individual, and that's why there's Kimlei D'Rabba Minei, even though it's inevitable that the Begam will happen at this point. El Amar of Chista, G'gon Shebaaleha Shelo Kedarka, G'sar Mabaaleha Kedarka. It's a situation where he first violated her, Shelo Kedarka, and then he violates her Kedarka. So violating Shalot Darkarka, that's where he was subject to the death penalty, the Kretot, because of sleeping with his sister. Then when he sleeps with her, Kedarka, she's been violated, the Begam has already happened. So the Begam doesn't exist anymore, so he's not subject to his life being taken to prevent it. Nevertheless, when he then has Biyah with her Kedarka, he removes her Bitulim, and that's when the monetary obligation happens. So then you hear you're completely separating the death penalty, which is subject when there's Pagam, which is the original Biyah, Shelo Kedarka. And here the second Biyah, which is Kedarka, removes the Betulim, and that's when the monetary obligation kicks in. And the Yad Ramah points out over here that even if he had Biyah with her Shelo Kedarka again, he'd still be B'chayav, because as the Bali Tosafot pointed out already, the Chiyuv for paying for the Knas has nothing to do with the removal of the Betulim, has to do with the violation of the woman. And so the pagam is already done in the first biyah, and that's the kimlei derabba minei goes away, and then the second biyah is chayav for the kenas, and so that could be even shelo kedarka. Rav Amar b'minichato shelo yaragena v'Rabbi Yehuda. That the case here is a case where it's Rabbi Yehuda who says that if she requests that you leave her alone, that you let him go. So in that case, she says, "Don't do anything; he's going to kill me." So then you have to back off. He's no longer subject to a death warrant. And then if he goes ahead and then removes her bitulim, at that point, he's chayav the money because there's no death warrant. There's no kimlei derabba minei. But Papa Amar, b'mefuta b'divrei Yaakov. It's a case of seduction and not rape, and that's according to everyone. By the case of mefuta, you're not allowed to save her by taking his life because she's not makpedet. She's a consensual partner over here. Even though she was seduced, and maybe she shouldn't have given in to the seduction, but nevertheless, she's considered to be consensual over there. You can't take the life of the individual. Since you can't take the life of the individual, he's not subject to a death warrant, and then he'll be subject to kenas that is associated with mifuta, because over there you don't have kimlei derabba minei. Tosafot over here discusses whether there is a kenas by the case of mifuta, where she consents to be involved in that relationship. He speaks about the fact that boshet, gam, and tsar, and all the other items that are paid in the case of Me'anes, by Mifuta, those are waived, because she was a willing party. The only question is the Knas still in force? And that's what Tosafot discussed over here, that this answer over here has to believe that the woman cannot waive her right to the Knas. Again, obviously, if it belongs to her father, she doesn't have a right to waive the Knas. But if it even belongs to her, the question of whether she can waive the Knas or not, or she's entitled to Knas, is subject to a machloket amoraim, and Tosafot says clearly this option in the Gemara follows that position that the knas is not waived in that instance. Abaye Amar, Abaye gives one more option, which is biyachol atzilo bechamei averav. Rabbi Yonatan ben Shaul, and that's based on the position of Rabbi Yonatan ben Shaul. The time Rabbi Yonatan ben Shaul omer, hudeif sheiru hudeif achar chaviro lohor go. Someone's chasing after another individual to kill him. Biyachol atzilo bechamei averav. You can stop him by maiming him and not using fatal force. Velo itzil, and you didn't do that, neragalav, you're going to be subject to a death penalty, you're going to be classified as a murderer in that case. It's a case where you can prevent them from perpetrating the crime by maiming him, doing something other than killing him. So then he's no kimlei derabba minei because he's not going to be killed. So he's not going to be killed, then when he violates her betulim, he's going to be chayav the knas because there's no death associated with saving the life of the woman. And in that instance, you don't have kimlei bidirabimine. So these are all scenarios in which you can have the individual raping their sister, which is subject to chayvei kretot, which is not enough to prevent the payment of money, but entering into that crime or perpetrating that crime subjects the individual to a death penalty, which should have obviated his need to pay the knas because of kimlei dirabimine. In each of these instances, the Amoraim give you an example where you separate the death warrant from the bitulim. Somehow, either he wasn't chayav mita, or is chiyuv mita terminated before he violated the woman's bitulim. And so by separating those two, there's no kimlei dirabimine. Okay, we're going to stop here. Six lines down on the top of Ayin Dad Aleph, and the Gemara will continue tomorrow explaining the reasoning or the logic behind Rabbi Yonatan ben Shaul's position over here.